The opening of the epic Imperial March, the Darth Vader theme composed by John Williams, and without doubt music that will bring many listeners back to their first cinematic encounter with the blockbuster 1977 George Lucas film Star Wars, a film that went on to become a global pop culture sensation and a film franchise that now encompasses 9 full-length feature films, most recent of which came to us in 2019 called The Rise of Skywalker. Music from the film series, all composed by John Williams, will be celebrated on Wednesday, May the 4th at 8 p.m. in the National Concert Hall with the RTE Concert Orchestra in a programme cleverly entitled May the 4th Be With You. And the conductor will be Stephen Bell, recently announced as principal guest conductor with the RTE Concert Orchestra, who will be the performing orchestra on the evening. And lovely to have Stephen with us on the programme this evening. I think, Stephen, am I right in saying that this is the first time in a concert situation that music, in fact, from all 9 of the films will be performed over the course of the concerts?
I think it will be. Good evening. Nice to speak to you. I think this is the first time because, as you quite rightly mentioned, Rise of Skywalker was only out just before Christmas 2019. So I guess kind of the whole world changed, didn't it, with regard to sort of live music and events early in 2020. And as we now emerge from the pandemic and start to do these concerts once again, I'm pretty sure that the May the 4th, yes, we couldn't resist the title, will be the first time that we're going to feature. And actually, we're going to do it in quite a clever way, too, because although we're going to bookend the programme with the sort of opening titles, the main theme from the original 1977 film, and end with the throne room, which is for many the kind of iconic scene, isn't it, from those early films. But actually, we're going to go through the programme in film chronological order. So starting with The Phantom Menace and going through the first sort of 3 prequels,
right,
and then the original trilogy of films, and then finishing up with Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, and Skywalker. So it kind of follows the narrative of the story, if you like, more than when the films were released, because there was an enormous gap, wasn't there, after Return of the Jedi. There was a kind of 16 or 17 years or whatever it was, hiatus, before we kind of rekindled everybody's interest in the Star Wars with the Phantom Menace.
And then we kind of got it backwards, because those early episodes were episodes 4, 5, and 6 of the 9 of the 9-part series. And lest we get ourselves tangled in a Star Wars knot, let's not try to explain where they all fit in. But one thing, even as I listened to that, the Imperial March, John Williams, back in a live situation in a concert hall, that is, it really is rousing music. He has a facility, he's a film composer after all, but he has a facility to create character and situation, you know, with a couple of notes, really, he does it. And then orchestrates those couple of notes brilliantly.
Absolutely does that better than just about anybody else. I absolutely agree with you. And particularly with regard to the Star Wars, because he pins these various themes on various characters, and we hear those through the course of the concert. Even if you're not familiar with the films, you know, you can kind of appreciate how the music works, how it relates to those films, but also how it stands up on its own to the sort of scrutiny of being played in the console. To me, that's the mark of great music.
Yeah, and I suppose what he does, if you think of that Darth Vader theme, it kind of, it develops across the series into other characters as well. He kind of switches and turns it and maybe plays around with variations on it in a wonderfully musically clever way.
It's not an original idea, and he's on record himself as saying he's kind of stolen the idea from Wagner, really, and had these kind of motifs for various characters. But isn't it clever how, like you say, he can just twist that or even just give us a little hint of it, even if the Darth Vader character isn't on screen. If you hear that really menacing music, and it does make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, even though it's 40-odd years old, you know that that character or the influence of that character isn't far away. So you know there's kind of danger or something lurking the dark side. It's really clever how he sometimes subliminally adds that kind of extra layer of emotional involvement to what you see on the screen. And as I say, Williams does that better than anybody. Yeah. You mentioned a couple of notes, you know, you've only got to think of Jaws.
Yeah.
That's the simplest kind of idea of a theme ever. But it's terrifying, and that film would be a lot less scary if it wasn't for the music.
Of course, as you say, he does acknowledge Wagner, and there are those who would say, if you listen to, well, if you've got 50 or 60 hours to spare and you listen to Wagner's Ring, you will hear every piece of film music, or certainly the influences on almost every piece of film music ever composed. But Williams is an original.
Absolutely is. I mean, he's very happy to kind of acknowledge that he's taking on that tradition of the orchestral soundtrack, by sort of harking back to those composers who did write, the classical composers who did write for cinema, and then those composers from the sort of golden era, if you like, the likes of Korngold and all those kind of characters, those emigres from Eastern Europe who went to Hollywood. So he acknowledges that, yes, that's kind of keeping that tradition going. But you say Wagner and you need Harold Miniaris to listen to The Ring. I bet if you added up all the music cues for 9 Star Wars films, I bet it's nearly as long as The Ring.
Probably
cycle,
something,
you know?
Similar, yeah.
There must be getting on for an hour's plus music for each film. So, you know, with the 9 films there, there's quite a lot of material to dive in and out of.
Obviously, you're speaking to us this evening as conductor and as principal guest conductor of the RTE Concert Orchestra, and we'll talk to you a little bit about what your plans are in that particular role. But you were, your first instrument was French horn. Now, I would have thought the French horn would be a great thing to be playing if you were playing the music of John Williams. There must be great themes and great solos for the horn player and stress for the horn players in the midst of all of that. Would you ever be tempted?
What, to play it again?
Yeah.
Well, I did. I've retired from playing now some 7 or 8 years ago, but was involved with 2 of the Star Wars soundtracks. I recorded Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith with the great man himself in Abbey Road Studios in London. And yes, you're absolutely right. The brass do get quite, well, every section of the orchestra does, but the brass do get quite a workout. And he uses the horn so superbly. I mean, you've only got to think of that wonderful theme he wrote for Princess Leia,
yeah,
or the Luke and Leia theme from one of the early films. You know, there are examples of it throughout, all the way through, that he writes just wonderful soaring melodies. And that's another reason, that's another way that he kind of tugs on the heartstrings, and the horn's the perfect instrument to do that.
Yeah, and you say, you worked with him on the recording of 2 of the soundtracks, did you say it was in total?
That's right, yeah.
What was the nature of the man in the recording studio? I mean, were you at that point solely concentrating on the music, or were you in one of those situations where there were visual cues up in front of you and you were watching things on screen as you played?
We don't get to see those.
The conductor watches those.
Williams, yes, he has a screen with a monitor. What's really interesting, of course, is that the film music does take quite a long time to put together, because all of these individual kind of links and tracks have to sync up completely to the film. So they're often done with click, which means that all the musicians sitting in the studio have got headphones on, and you're slightly limited in a way with your kind of interpretation. Obviously, he's synchronized all the visuals to the music that he's recorded, but in a way that almost puts an extra layer of not being able to be as free as you like. It's really difficult for a film composer, because you've got to stick to the brief, but you've also got to stick to making it fit the visuals, which have already been edited by that stage. It's one of the last parts of the film production, so that's really hard.
Yeah.
And it means actually that recording a film score does take quite a long time. I can't remember exactly how many sessions there were for these, but there must be 20 plus hours of recording sessions.
But as you say,
to record a film.
It maybe explains why Williams in particular is one of those composers who maybe has a 2, 3 or 4 note theme, so that if he's suddenly told, you know, that character, you need you to introduce him in or her in 5 seconds, you know, so don't be giving us a big long flowing legato line that's 14 bars long. We need 5
exactly.
seconds. So 3, 4, 5 notes, that's kind of why he probably why he has those little short snappy motifs
that you can kind of pick up on those really quickly. And also the other thing with the film composer is you don't have acres and acres of time to go, well, I'll just, you know, wait till the muse hits me and I'll write something.
Yeah.
The pressure is on, because the film is cut and the release date is set and, you know, all those deadlines. It's a really high pressure. He's incredibly focused on the box, incredibly well, because he's a particularly gifted conductor. He was principal conductor of the Boston Pops for many, many years. So he's very much at home, you know, in a conductor capacity, which not all film composers are, and very much kind of in control of the sessions as they run. And of course, he knows the music intimately because he wrote it. So ultimately, that's the best way of him to kind of not hand that over to somebody else to conduct his work. He's really happy in doing that. So, yeah, incredibly focused, an amazing ear for detail.
Yeah, I'll give details out again just in a second. But just before I go to a final piece of music, Stephen, this role as the principal guest conductor of the RTE Concert Orchestra, any plans that you might like to share with us?
Well, we've lots of things in the pipeline. I mean, we began this year when I started the job in February of this year, celebrating Williams' 90th birthday. We did a couple of concerts out on the West Coast, which were lovely. We've also got 60 years of James Bond this year, which is something I'd really love to do with the orchestra, bring a couple of great vocalists across to do that. We have plans for concerts around Halloween. We've got big plans for concerts at Christmas, because, of course, we've not been able to do Christmas concerts for the last couple of years. And a big focus and a big priority for me as well is to get the orchestra out into the regions, which again, you know, because of COVID and whatever else, we've not been able to do. We've a couple of plans coming up that I'm not quite allowed to talk about, but there's a big project for Collins Barracks coming up at the end of the summer, at the end of August, which will feature music by, all I can say is, Ireland's most prominent and iconic songwriter and artist. He answers on a postcard.
I'd love
to be able to tell you what that is, but it's something that the concert orchestra have never done before. And to me, that's part of the kind of joy of the job with them, that they have such a versatility and such an ability to play in all these musical styles and genres. Yeah. So to bring something new that they've never done before, because obviously they do a lot of film music. They do pop, sure. They do jazz, they do trad.
Great stuff, yeah.
They do new music Dublin, they do all the classical stuff. You know, to bring something that's a little off-piste, if you like, and something that's new and fresh for the first time. Well, that introduces new audiences to what we do. Yeah. So,
and I sincerely hope, when you can tell, that you will tell me immediately. And hopefully, maybe
indeed.
Even first, if you could try that for me, I would be very happy. But certainly tell me very quickly. Great, it's great to speak with you this evening, Stephen. That's Stephen Bell, Principal Guest Conductor of the RTE Concert Orchestra. May the 4th be with you. Concert drawing on music from all 9 movies in the Star Wars franchise will be staged on Wednesday of next week, May the 4th, at the National Concert Hall. The programme will be presented by our colleague Aidan Gormley from RTE Lyric FM. And you can find out full details on nch.ie. Call My Agent, the acclaimed French comedy drama available on Netflix, is getting a British remake. The English language adaptation is called 10%, which is a nod to the commission that talent agents receive, and it will be hitting Prime Video this Thursday. 10%, of course, 10% was the original French title as well. But throughout this new English language version, the series, which comes from the BAFTA award winner John Morton, 2012, and W1A being among his other credits, the cast will be joined by a host of A-list guests stars playing themselves as clients of the fictional London talent agency Nightingale Heart. And Sophie Gorman joins me now of Le Monde in English. She joins me this evening to tell us about this series. Let's talk first of all, Sophie, about Call My Agent, 10%, the original French version here. Just remind us about that series and why it was hugely successful.
I think it was because it was just so refreshing. It wasn't a guilty pleasure for everybody. It was more just of a pleasure. It was very satirical, very sexy, very funny. And what was wonderful was you had all these big stars who just essentially, it was incredibly self-deprecating. They just took they mocked themselves with shamelessly. They acted up. They were very melodramatic. I mean, you had huge names like Isabelle Huppert being ridiculous, running around Paris and completely overacting. Isabelle Adjani, Beatrice Dahl, even Sigourney Weaver was in it. There were huge names, and they all just had fun, and they clearly had fun. But at its heart, and at the heart of this new series, is the agency. The agency in this one is called Nightingale Heart, but in the original it was ASK. And it's very much almost like a family drama set in an agency. We have all these characters that are archetypal characters, but they give us, it's their relationships that we really hang on. And then added into that mix, you have these stars just having a hoot, just enjoying themselves.
And as you say, in some of the, in a lot of the episodes in the French language version, the 10%, Call My Agent, as we called it, as when we watched it on Netflix, there were a lot of French stars, French film stars, French theatre stars who took the mickey out of themselves, essentially made fun of themselves on screen. But there were some big international names. I guess one of the reasons to remake these things is to make it a little bit more, I suppose, relevant and maybe featuring stars that a local audience will be more familiar with. Because there have been several remakes, really, haven't there?
This is actually, it's a quite extraordinary success of the original. It was the idea of this agent, Dominique Besnehard, And he'd been an agent for 20 years, and he decided it was time to tell his story. And then he did a great move. He linked up with Fanny Herrero, who was the main writer on 10%, Call My Agent. And the success of this show is, I mean, it's extraordinary. It has been remade in Turkey and India. There are at least 7 remakes and adaptations in progress, and now there's the English version, which is out now. I think, yes, each one is trying to put its own stamp on it, and yet, you know, use the same framework as the original. John Morton, as you mentioned, he's quite well known for it, or he's very well known for his the more satirical dramas of 2012 and W1A. Here he's actually set himself an unusual brief. He's tried to make a more gentle version of Call My Agent in 10%. That was, he said,
yeah,
also that he didn't think, I'm not sure how true this is, because I know that during lockdowns, people in Ireland binge watched Call My Agent, but he thinks that people have a problem with subtitles still, and that's why he thought it was really important that it got an English language outing.
Right. Well, let's have a listen to a clip. As you say, I suppose essentially the important dynamic as the series develops is in fact what's going on in the office. It's a family drama. It's an office drama. The hook is the big stars who come in, which means we get great guest stars. I suppose that one of the issues we need to know about here is Rebecca, played by Lydia Leonard. She really is the nasty bit of work in the office, nasty bits of work.
Yeah, if people will remember the original, there was Camille Cotard's Andrea Martel, and Rebecca is Andrea in this version. She's the driven, seemingly cold one. She's put her personal life on hold in her push for success. And yeah, she's willing to do whatever it takes to get the clients and to keep them.
Yeah, well, in this clip, we hear Rebecca then, the Lydia Leonard. Her client is Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and an error has been made in a cake that was sent to her that was supposed to go to Maggie Smith. So in this clip then, Misha, who's a new character, just happens to be at reception looking for a job, and she kind of saves the day. We'll also hear Harry Trevaldwin here as Ollie, another one of the assistants, and Maggie Steed, who's a big senior agent called Stella. But yeah, strong language, it must be said. Rebecca likes to use her language when she is rather annoyed, as she is here.
Fucking great, isn't it? My fucking assistant. I fired her, by the way. I totally fired her. And the one thing that now Phoebe knows for sure is that her agent is some fuckwit.
And that's before we get to Maggie.
Oh, Maggie's mad anyway. It doesn't matter.
You don't mean that. You're upset. I'm going to forgive you.
I think maybe she did, actually.
Oh, shut up, Ollie.
Yes, okay.
She might not actually think that.
So, excuse me?
Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She might not think you're a fuckwit. So her character in the film has this major fantasy where she's Margaret Thatcher, like it actually takes over her life for a bit. I heard her talk about it in a podcast. So actually, the cake could end up being a pretty cool present. Sorry, it's just, I really love Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Right. And who the hell are you?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm Misha.
Misha?
Yes. I mean, I'm just here.
Yes, evidently.
I just came in to ask about jobs.
Jobs?
Yes.
What kind of jobs?
Oh, well,
I suppose you want a job as an assistant, do you, Misha?
Yes, I do.
And so she's part of the cast. How wonderful life would be if it was just like that. That's a scene from 10%, the new English language remake of 10%, or Call My Agent. And this is coming from Prime Video. Obviously, Call My Agent was available to us on Netflix at the time. Sophie Gorman has been watching it for us, and she's speaking to me this evening. Sophie, we have that, obviously, that office dynamic is there, but the name drops are astonishing. And it's not just name dropping in terms of the big clients that are being dealt with. It is every week we get a big guest star.
In both versions, in the first episode, we have Kelly MacDonald. In the second episode, we've got Alina Bonham Carter and Olivia Williams. Then you've got people like Dominic West and Emma Curran and Himesh Patel. Yeah, there are some big, big names who've obviously, I think, as with the original Call My Agent, the first season, there were big French names. But after that, there were much bigger international names because people realized that this was an opportunity that they would never have, the big actors, to just go and essentially, as you said, to take the mickey out of their profession and their egos and everything that's wrapped up with being a big, big star. And so
Although I did notice, in particularly in the first, I watched the first episode today, which is the one that features Kylie MacDonald, who was on with us a couple of weeks back. And I asked her, I said to her, oh, are you a bit of a diva in this? And she said, no, I'm being myself. And she's the last. If there's one thing she's not, certainly from my experience of talking to her, there's no sense of diva in her at all. You mentioned that John Martin, who's the writer here and who's the showrunner, I guess, he was looking for a gentler version. I got the sense that there was a kind of a more serious tone to the idea that was being explored around the Kelly MacDonald character.
Well, I don't know if you've seen the original, but the themes, the episode structures are all actually taken from the original Call My Agent, each episode, which is a pity, to be honest, because if you've seen the original, there are no surprises. Yeah. You know exactly what's coming. So those elements were, that exact element was discussed in the very first episode of Call My Agent with Cécile de France, faced up to that issue of, this is not giving a huge amount away, but of aging and women actors, what happens to them when they age, and the cruel responses that are given out to them, even by their agents. And what is nice here in this one is that, like actually in the original, but we have Dan Prasanna Purnaraja. And he's her agent, and he's the bumbling, affable one. He's the one who wears his heart on his sleeve. He's the one who creates disasters and then even bigger disasters to mop them up. So we have an actress who has somebody who actually cares about her and how they together work their way through this issue of aging and the difficulties that actors face.
Yeah, and one of the other agents in the office, it's a family agency, Jonathan, who's the son of one of the big agents who started the whole thing off, played by Jack Davenport. He manages to pull Kelly MacDonald off to the side at one point in the episode, and he's slipping, as you'll hear in this clip, he's slipping something across the table to her, which is the suggestion that she might get a little bit of work done, and therefore the ageing issue would not be as big a problem. So let's listen to how that scene plays out between Jack Davenport as Jonathan and Kelly MacDonald as herself, or a version of herself.
So, I mean,
I think I just feel duty-bound, really, to give you this.
Is it?
Yeah, there was a time, if you want to see a guy like this, where you come out looking like Melanie Griffith, whatever you look like going in.
Wait, are you,
No, I'm not suggesting anything. But this guy, I mean, it is like he has a secret power flowing through him. You really do come back looking like you.
Look, I know what the deal is, okay? But this is a fork in the road for me.
Yeah.
I'm mostly comfortable with who I am. I know too many people who aren't, and I know where that ends up.
Yeah.
I mean, not your wife, obviously.
No. Okay, well, great. That's great. Just to say, you know, we'll support you, whatever you choose to do. So forget Birdwoman, forget money, career, awards, forget all that. Everyone has their defining moment. I just want to make sure you're holding all the cards.
And that's Jack Davenport as Jonathan and Kelly MacDonald in herself in a scene there from the first episode of 10%, the new remake of the original French language, Deep Person, Call My Agent. Sophie, I mentioned that gentler thing, and I take your point that, yes, the episode structures are similar, but I got a sense that there was kind of more maybe flamboyance and slightly more farcical nature to the French language version, whereas it was a much more restrained, in my mind anyway, a more restrained version on the basis of that first episode.
Yes, it's more stiff upper lip, British stiff upper lip, I think. And actually, just to mention, in terms there, not to say that there's no originality, because one of the original twists is that Jack Davenport as Jonathan, he's the son of the main the head agent Richard Nightingale, played by Jim Broadbent, which is obviously a different dynamic than in the original. And there's also a repeat character played by the wonderfully, and this is a slightly flamboyant character, Tim McInerney, who for me will always be Lord Percy in Blackadder, but here he plays a very weepy and alcoholic lovey called Simon. That's a new repeat character that we haven't had before. But yes, as you say, in the French version, in the second episode of the French version, we have two octogenarian actresses who are put up for the same part by their different agents. And they clash wonderfully and gloriously at a wake, you know, ripping each other to shreds, tearing lumps out of each other and enjoying every second of it.
Yeah.
In this version, the same setup, the two actresses decide that their friendship is worth more than...
Ah, that's interesting, yeah.
And it's just not, it doesn't have as much, it's not as joyful, I suppose.
Yeah, so should we watch Call My Agent in its entirety before we watch this, before we watch The English, or should we just...
Oh gosh, no.
Go for 10% and leave it at that, or what would you say?
Is it any good? It's grand, but the French version is a million times better, but this is very watchable, and if you've never seen the French version, it'll be very entertaining.
Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm from Paris.
Oh, I wonder, is there any bias in your decision to tell us to watch the French language version first?
I should like to pick up a few words of French.
Right. Deeper some. Okay. Deuce point to you. Thanks very much, Sophie. That's Sophie Gorman speaking to us about 10%, that English language version. All eight episodes, in fact, will of the first series, presumably there will be more than one, will be available from this Thursday, April the 28th, and that is on Prime Video. Pitt Lullabies is the third portrait collection from Jessica Traynor, following Liffey Swim in 2014 and The Quick in 2019. These new poems reflect Jessica's recent experience of new parenthood. She has two young daughters. A New Life offers a clear frame of reference for this world, the century, the bodies and the habits we live in, not least the wonder and the inherent dangers of both the natural and man-made worlds. Jessica has also been busy elsewhere. She co-hosts a weekly podcast with poet Sean Hewitt, but I'm delighted to have her sitting opposite me in studio this evening. I'm going to get you, actually, if you wouldn't mind, Jessica, to read a poem that I had actually chosen. I really wanted to hear you read. It's from, there's a big sequence in the middle of the collection called On Poisons, where you go through, I think it's 9 or 10, isn't it, different weeds or plants, and you tell us about them. You're going to read the section called Wolf's Bane.
Wolf's Bane. Oh, Granny, how tight your bonnet, how bright the miraculous metal against liver-spotted skin, how fearful the hump of your back, your wren bones that once held the three girls thrashing to escape you, how you wait in your bed, pink tongue lolling, for the men who would hack through your door to meet your teeth, dulled but still sharp. You never knew who deserved your bite, the woodsman who would club you till blood-tinged clumps of fur, or the girls in their red hoods who didn't want your consolation.
That's Jessica Traynor reading her poem Wolf's Bane from a sequence called On Poisons from her new collection, Pitt Lullabies. I wanted to start with that, Jessica, because right throughout that sequence, more so than in many other places, every plant that you write about, there's an inherent danger. In this case, you know, it's Granny who's going to eat you up in Little Red Riding Hood fashion, because she's really, you know, the wolf in behind it all.
Yeah.
Was there something driving this sense of danger or sense of, you know, impending disaster all around you at the time of writing?
Do you know, this is an unusual sequence, Sean, and I'm really gratified that people have responded well to it, because I wrote this purely for private use. This was an exercise for myself. I never really intended for it to go anywhere. And then I showed it to a friend of mine, Jamie Murphy of the Salvage Press, and he kind of went wild about it. And I thought maybe there's something in this. But I suppose I was trying to look at the anxieties that we all face as parents, you know, and there's this thing that happens that all of the existential dread that you know, we all walk around in this cloud of existential dread, particularly at the moment. But when you become a parent, that becomes kind of actualized into the being of another person, and you think this isn't really existential anymore. This is just the real world happening everywhere. And I was thinking as well, you know, with my kind of theatre background, about Hamlet and Ophelia in Hamlet, and how she starts to speak in the language of flowers when she goes mad. And I think, like many new parents, I felt a little bit mad myself. So I tried to look at the kind of the language and lore of plants and flowers as a way really to explore dangerous people and complicated circumstances.
Now, given that it is in and around parenthood, can you lay out the parent story, if you like? Because you have two daughters. So in terms of their ages and births, where did the writing come?
Well, really, a lot of this collection came from the period after the birth of my first daughter, where I was working a lot, travelling a lot, especially as a judge for the Irish Times Awards, which meant that I was all over the country, maybe two or three nights a week, and various other projects where I'd had to spend a lot of time travelling by night. And there's something about missing that bedtime and then missing the getting getting up in the morning, that becomes very, very difficult. So the kind of collection and the sequence of Pitt lullabies came out of a sense of trying to write to my daughter from that distance.
Yeah, and while the On Poison sequence, which really jumped out at me when I read it, as you said, it did for Jamie as well, the Pitt lullabies, those, they're kind of placed throughout the collection. There's one every five or six poems, roughly. There's a Pitt lullaby, and there's a sense of a Pitt stop about it, if you like, that it kind of, and it sets off another section of poems. But these were, you were trying to kind of come to terms with, what age was your daughter at that time when you were writing these?
Well, I probably would have started writing them from the time she was as young as 4 months, which was the first time I had to take some journeys away from her, right through till the age of two. And it was kind of a journey through those very difficult days of early parenthood, the broken sleep, the anxiety, the postnatal depression, I suppose, really, when I look at it. And it was kind of trying to write my way through that experience, but also write to her. And we kind of make a journey from the darkness into something that maybe is not quite as simple as light.
Yeah.
But it's about trying to kind of not be alone in the darkness, really. Yeah.
So in some ways, what you're talking about is you're there, if you're at home, you're thinking, oh, I wish I could get some sleep. And when you're away from home, you're kind of thinking, I wish I was at home not getting some sleep.
Absolutely. I mean, it's never simple.
Yeah.
It really isn't.
Maybe you'd read one of the Pitt lullabies for us, because they kind of work as a sequence up. There are 10 of them in total.
Yes.
I don't want to give away the ending, if you like, but I think we can hint at what comes towards the end. The seventh of them, I think, is the one you're going to read for us, isn't it?
Yeah, and this has a little reference in it to the very beloved Mog books by Judith Kerr. Pitt Lullaby 7. When we turn off the light and I hold you close, your face becomes a puzzle, a wisp of hair settling on a cheek, an eyebrow like a capstone sinking in a restless sea. Here I whisper to you broken thoughts that settle on the tangle of our limbs. Mog sat in the dark and thought dark thoughts, I say, because it is the only thing in any of your books I recognise as true, a beast alone out of doors and far from home. I lie in the dark and think dark thoughts while your feet push my thighs away. I make a weapon of the weight of my bones. There are so many hours between us and the morning.
And that's Jessica Traynor reading Pitt Lullaby 7 from her new collection, her new poetry collection, Pitt Lullabies. And I suppose we get it. We get a sense of that there then, this kind of in-between space. But you mentioned Judith Kerr and the Mog books. Yeah. Is it at the beginning of that poem that you quote a little section from Mog books?
Yeah, it's actually the next, I think it's the next poem, or maybe number 9, where there's a little line that says, and who else is here in the dark, which I love as well, because when you take it on your own, it does start to seem quite sinister in a sense, in these books that are very sweet otherwise.
But I guess that's there in the Wolf's Bane thing as well, where you're picking up on that darkness that is sometimes there in the fairy tales.
Yeah.
But the story in terms of parenthood, and in terms of this collection, I think it moves on. There's a second act, because so your daughter is in and around two, you're saying, between 4 months and two, when those lullabies are written. When does daughter number two arrive?
Well, so daughter number two arrives then during lockdown, as a lockdown baby, and actually was the inspiration for one of the earlier poems in the book, which deals with an anatomy scan. Because between my two anatomy scans, you know, this is something that happens during the pregnancy, the Rotunda had gotten a really fancy new machine for the second time. So the second experience was way more high tech than the first one, and they had all these different pulsing colours. It was very surreal.
And given that you were, that was the lockdown baby, were you in for that anatomy scan by yourself then?
Yes, yeah.
That's a very different experience.
A very different experience. So I think, you know, I was hoping for an easier ride the second time round, and that's not necessarily the way it went. But I kind of, I suppose at that stage I had the confidence of having done it all once before, but it was still very strange.
But there is that moment, you know, particularly with, I suppose, the scan of a first child, where, you know, both parents, when the heartbeat is played for you for the first time, I mean, it's breathtaking.
Yes.
To experience that by yourself, I would say, is a very different experience. Now, it was your second time round, but
Yeah.
it's not as if you're doing them every turn around, scans.
Exactly. No, it was very strange. And also, it is a time of intense vulnerability, because it is always the time for many parents where you might learn that something is not as it should be. So, yes, I think that energy and the kind of uncanniness of that informed the anatomy scan poem, which I might read.
Yeah, you might read that for us now.
Anatomy scan. Let's begin with a shroud darkened by time,
pushed aside to show your bones filigree. The ultrasound probes and digs as you slither in and out of focus, sockets gaping like a Halloween ghost through a sheet. The hole of your stomach, the chomp of your heartbeat hungering below my gut. Perfect cerebellum, a very nice spine. There, the kidneys, little dark pockets of need. Colour flares across the screen, arterial flow through widening chambers, its rush exhausting. The eyeballs orbit, closed but watchful. Your twig arms flinch and flick, your tiny jaws grin. Little lizard, you know something I've forgotten.
And that's Anatomy Scan from Jessica Traynor's new collection, Pit Lullabies. You know, there's often this debate, Jessica, I suppose, around who is the I. When a poet is writing about an I, that I could not isn't necessarily the poet, him or herself. Is there any question here, but you're talking about you and you're talking about your children? There is no kind of filter in between that, is there?
No, I mean, and actually it's the first time in my third collection where I've kind of felt that I've earned that right to always write or felt that desire to write very much in the eye. I suppose with my last collections, I probably would have been looking at political situations that were at a bit more of a distance from my own experience. Whereas here, I suppose I'm trying to talk a little bit about, you know, the uncanniness, the strangeness of childbirth, but it is a political act being a parent. In the world today. So I was kind of keen to explore that.
Speaking of political acts, and I will come back to the collection, I want to talk briefly about Paper Boat, because that really came out of, did that grow out of, this was the story of a migrant mother seeking and child seeking shelter in St. Nicholas's Church in Galway. A composer, Elaine Agnew, it was her opera. You provided the libretto for it. Did that grow out of the series of events that you did with Stephen Ray around direct provision?
Yes, I mean, it all kind of came about around the same time. So I would have started the commission to write the libretto back in 2019. And, you know, it's very interesting because people have said to me about the opera, oh my goodness, it feels so relevant now because of what's happening in Ukraine. But, I mean, sadly, the world was no different in 2019. You know, these things, movement of people is happening all of the time. So I think that this kind of a story will always be relevant again, sadly. But a lot of the inspiration came from my work and research with Mark Dooley around St. Nicholas's Collegiate Church, which is a kind of a place of meeting for so many different communities and faiths, and people who have come to Ireland from other countries, people who are homeless. So it is a place of sanctuary. So the kind of the, yes, absolutely my own experience as a mother, which was something that had been informing my work at that time, my experience of working with people in direct provision, all of that kind of came together, but the story kind of came organically from the church itself.
But I wonder, what's the different, how different, what kind of is the emotional input when you're writing about something, a very political, very moving story, very difficult story sometimes to tell and important stories to be told. The difference between that and delving into your own private emotions and your own private and family life and laying that bare on the page?
It's a really interesting question. I think at the end of the day, you know, I'm always very wary of, I would never want to appropriate anyone else's experience. So really, the only way I could be equal, I think, to this subject was just to write my own kind of experience and emotional truth. And every mother, parent has experienced some form of separation from their child. And I think if we try and realise that, of course, that experience is for everybody. That's the common thread that unites us all. Then that's the kind of birth of empathy that you're hoping to create, that people will sit and watch this opera and say, that could be me, that could be my child.
And writing poems and writing poetry, is that about trying to give empathy some kind of place as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you really are always hoping that you will speak to somebody who will feel their experience reflected back at them in some way that is useful for them.
Will you finish by reading Lessons? This is quite far into the collection, really, isn't it? So we have a lot of the story at this point. It's almost as if you get, some things are being learned or have been learned.
Absolutely. And I think this is about the moments in life where death kind of comes to greet us or comes a little bit closer to us than we might like. Lessons. Your birth left me drenched in night sweats, grew the knowledge in me that death was polishing coins for us all those long pre-anesthetic ages, ready to take us both, your shoulders shut in the door jamb of my pelvis, what strange skeletons we would have made.
And for a moment I was the future ghost of all those pale small girls you picture in the background in old novels where great men are saying great things. I was a great pale tide of little Marys. I tell a lie. I first met Death at 7, on the stairs of the 15 bus. He had no body, but he lived behind my eyes, swung space sideways till I could see 1,000 crashes spiral out and all the cold dead faces. And on the hourglass's wasp-cinched waist, there's you, as much your father as you are me, and twice again yourself, double helix spiralling as the world turns and turns, phosphorus spark in the great dark laboratory. And after you, I still see Death on my left shoulder, ready to flip this egg-timer world, but now I save a space for you inside me. I wear the skin a little looser on my bones.
Jessica Traynor with her poem Lessons from her collection Pit Lullabies, which is published by Blood Axe Books. And I should mention as well, I mentioned in the introduction about the podcast that you're co-hosting, Jessica, with Sean Hewitt. This is for this year's Dublin Literary Award. You're going through the shortlists and you're looking at all the books, speaking to the authors and yourself and Sean basically discussing the books as you go along. So very interesting one to keep an eye on as well. Pit Lullabies, Jessica's new collection, published by Blood Axe Books, and full programme for the International Literature Festival Dublin, and indeed details of that podcast, ilfdublin.com, the ILFD website, or on SoundCloud, Spotify or Apple is where you will find Jessica and Sean Hewitt's podcast. Well, now that we're all going out again, might a trip to a drive-in bingo night with an aerial dance show be the ticket for you? If so, Ireland's leading circus company, Fidget Feet Aerial Dance Theatre, have a new show, a sequel to Bingo Wings, their previous bingo-inspired show, which they talked to us about back in 2009. This latest show is called House. It brings bingo fever to the 1980s Royal Broadway Parish Bingo, which takes place in the Dunshinnie Community Hall car park. People are dealing with the shocking and amazing breaking news that John O'Dowd of Hollywood fame will be replacing the Royal Broadway's stalwart bingo caller of 30 years. But why am I telling you all of this? I should leave it to somebody much more accomplished. Dunshinnie's star broadcaster, Hugh Prendergast, or should I say Prendergast, he will introduce the new show after he's introduced.
That was a Jailhouse Jig by the Three J's, Mr. Joyful Jacob Joyce, and his three pieces of a one-man band. And here now to preview what is coming up on today's edition of Driveline, the daily show where local news is given the global spin, is our indomitable rating star, the radio wizard who puts Spellcast in broadcast, our very own Hugh Prendergast.
That's Prendergast, Cynthia.
Prendergast. Hugh, huger than life, Prendergast.
Well, today's Driveline is totally dominated by the breaking news that tonight's bingo at the Royal Broadway Hall...
Bingo at the Broadway Hall!
Oh, Jesus. ...will be called by none other than John O'Dowd. No, not the usual John O'Dowd who has been calling the bingo since I was a long lad in short pants, mind you, but the other one, the world-famous John O'Dowd from such films as Revenge of the Broken Banshees, Volume 3, Anteater vs. Kangaroo, Redux, and Equal Rights for Street Fight 6. Shocking stuff here today on Dunshinnie Community Radio.
Dunshinnie Community Radio.
Get your calls and texts into 1840 123 456, because the drive line is motoring and today we are really sucking diesel, so we are.
Dunshinnie Local Radio, key component of Fidget Feet, the aerial dance show's new production, which is called House. I'm delighted to be joined by director and choreographer Chantal McCormick. Don't correct how I say your name, please, Chantal.
No, you're grand.
That's great. That's, I thought, between Prendergast and Prendergast, I hope it's McCormick and not McCormack. Oh. Anyway, there we go. Listen, Bingo Wings, the previous... incarnation, if you like, or the first version of this show in some ways, was inspired by your own childhood in County Donegal. It was your grandfather was a caller of bingo numbers, and your grandmother considered you her lucky charm, I believe, when you went to the bingo. Where are you in this bingo story?
Well, So I thought that that we weren't done with bingo. So in this one, I didn't know while I was making it, but now that it's made, it's kind of like for my mum, Paula McCormick, who's still up in Donegal flying it. And it's her love of Elvis and bingo. And I think, you know, Bingo Wings was 2019 and we had a big tour that we were planning on 2020. And like most things, it's gone to bed for a wee while. So I thought, what would people love to do once we get out of all this crap? Drive in a bingo and have Elvis impersonators on vintage tractors, have aerialists flying off a crane and marching bands. And basically, I just let my imagination go wild. And then working with my husband, Jim Daly, on the writing and the music was just so much fun. Even listening to that.
Yeah.
Even listening to it, I'm cackling myself like, yeah.
So it was yourself and then, as you say, your partner, Jim, who decided to. Is it a kind of a follow on then from Bingo Wings, or is it just episode two? You don't need to have seen episode one.
Oh, yeah, because Bingo Wings was our indoor show and I was working with Tom Swift and Joe. And we, you know, the themes were there. Do you know, like, I just wanted to make a show about bingo and really combine theatre and circus. Whereas this one is, you know, Fidget Feet were renowned and we're known for all our aerial crane work. But I wanted to, like, before the opening, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible. Mm. Like, because it's trying to bring community involvement, flying off cranes, which we know, but audiences watching a show in a car. So you can't even see a crane out the top of the roof. So there was a lot of things that I didn't know what was or could work. But when the audience came and they beeped the horns like mad and all the little kids are there like playing their bingo and then there's like, you know, street dancers out their window and we didn't know if audience would actually come out of the cars when we would invite them and they did. And then we had like a good old rave at the end.
Well, you know, I'm not surprised that they did come out of the cars because I'm going to take a piece of music up underneath because less people think that the quality of the music is all of the nature that we just heard. It's not. Let's have a listen to this little section of music, and after we hear a bit of it, I'll get you to describe what might be going on for the people who are there. That's real action sequence type of music as far as I'm concerned, Chantal McCormick. Chantal McCormick of Fidget Feet is talking to us this evening about their new bingo dance show called House. So what are people looking at as they're hearing that, you know, type of music?
Yeah, no, you're grand. Yeah, because this is kind of the end. So we've already gone through Elvis. We've gone through a bagpipe music marching band. We've gone through cheerleaders and like people flying off a crane. And so I kind of thought, what else do we need? We need a couple of BMX, bicycle, street dancers and youth groups. And then we're flying off the crane. So this is kind of near the end. And it's really nice because then all of the people that are participating in the show are dancing together while we're up in the air. And Elvis is up in the air and the bingo caller finally gets up in the air. And the people are out of the car. So it's a real... it's a real feel-good kind of show. And
what I emphasise there is, you know, because yes, I mean, we can hear that you're knocking fun out of some local radio now, and it's you that's knocking fun out of them. Let me be very clear about that. But there's a very technically and a very expert side to your shows in that aerial work that you do. Like, you don't get up on a crane and you don't swing around on BMX bikes and the like in the mid-air unless you know what you're at.
Yeah, to be fair, that's true. Yeah, and we're 24 years now at the moment. So, yeah, and what's exciting about this show, it's very important for me coming from Donegal. And when I grew up, there wasn't much dance or anything. So I had to travel abroad and then come home. So I really love training Irish-based and Irish-born people to be able to be aerialists if that's what they want to do. So this project is not just about the show. We also have like an initiative called Soar Ups, where we have recent dance graduates that we've been training them up and in the air. And then we have other new aerialists that we've been training up to go into the air as well. So we run the Irish Aerial Creation Centre. Yeah. Fidget Feet is resident company there. So we're really lucky to have this massive, amazing space that we can train everyone up. We've got all the professional kit. And
that's a big part of it. I do want to hear a little bit of Elvis.
Or yes.
Elvis of a kind before we go. Let's have a listen to this.
Well, it's one for the money. For the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go! But don't you step on my blue suede shoes? Don't you step on my blue suede shoes? I can do anything but lay off of them blue suede shoes.
Now, with the greatest of respect to your Elvis impersonator, probably not of the level of skill of your aerial exploits, I'm guessing.
That's actually my husband. That's the composer, but it's the whole tongue-in-cheek of it, you know.
Yes, like of course.
If you know, what local towns... I grew up in Balbafame. Everyone has an Elvis impersonator, and, you know, they know... to them, they are Elvis. And what's hilarious is my mum surprised me and came to see the show in Ennis, and the Elvis that was playing the show is a female, but she had the whole gear on and the you know, the false hair. So she asked mum at the end of the show, so what do you think of the Elvis like? And mum was like, yeah, no, it wasn't very good. Didn't really have the hip action. So mummy started giving him tutorials on how to be Elvis. So we've got work to do there. So the next show will be better.
Yeah, fair enough. By the way, do you actually play a game of bingo at any point along the way?
Yes.
Yeah, do play a bingo. That's
vital. Of course.
Vital.
And that's the thing, you see. When we made Bingo Wings together at the beginning, there was a little bit of that. It was like we were and we weren't. And so then I thought, you know, because I did some research, and before COVID there used to be some drive-in bingos anyway, and it really interests me. And right. Once you're in the car, you're kind of in this safe bubble and you're hearing the crack and the radio thing that you were listening to before. That's our pre-show, so that people can get all the backstory and get into the story of it. Right. So all these little kids are like playing their bingo, and we have spot prizes and local businesses.
Yeah, so real family fun is clearly what you're talking about. Yeah. Lovely to speak to you this evening, Chantal. That's Chantal McCormick telling us about Fidget Feet Show House. Continues its tour, moving from Clare to the Limerick Racecourse. It was in Ennis, I think, a couple of weeks back at the Mart. It's moving then from Clare to the Limerick Racecourse on May the 1st and 2nd, then moves on to County Galway. And get full details of all of the venues of the tour on fidgetfeet.com.